You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Let's jump in first foremost with the, well, evidently Trump and the Democrats have come up with a, and look, I guess, you know, Democrats don't do this well. They really don't do the hostage situation well. They really don't do the holdout for every bit of pound of flesh that they want. But the debt limit is, well, the crisis hath been averted as the Democrats and the Republicans have come together and agreed that we're going to just, I guess, do away with the debt ceiling until July of 2021, which, again, I'm somebody who believes we shouldn't even have it. It's idiotic. It's another one of those constructs that only Republicans have been able to leverage in the way that they do, in the scorched earth way that they do. Now, like I said, July 31st of 2021, and no more debt ceiling. There won't be another debt ceiling fight until then. So all of the automatic cuts that were going to happen, they're not going to happen. Not going to reduce domestic spending by $55 billion. Not going to reduce military spending by $71 billion compared to 2019 levels. In fact, the next two fiscal years of 2020 and 2021, we will see deficits in excess of $1.37 trillion. Now, remember, you know, the reason I think this is important is because here we are at a moment when the economy is supposed to be never better. This is supposed to be it, man. This is supposed to be the best it gets. This is a booming. I keep reading this all over the place. This is a booming economy. It's booming. I remember the Clinton economy was booming. I remember wages going up. I remember buying power going up. Not so much seeing that right now. In fact, I see a lot of people really still very uneasy, even though people are being repeatedly told. And this is the Trump effect. And you got to give Trump credit for this. The one thing that he is really, really, really good at is this Carnival Barker. You know, this is the greatest show on earth. This is the greatest economy on earth. You know, everything he touches supposedly is the best ever. And he really does, you know, hammer on that message. I mean, from top to bottom of the administration, that's their MO. And look, yeah, on a certain level, I think had Obama done some of that, had he done some cheerleading of his own with what had happened after Bush's recession, you know, maybe. The Republicans wouldn't have, you know, whipped the hell out of them in 2010. Maybe you wouldn't have lost 1,000 seats across the country. Just kind of saying, maybe if you'd have, you know, tooted the horn a little bit and said, you know what, we're digging out and things are good and they're getting better and it's going to be great again. Just a thought. I understand this is the supposedly the best economy, where we're all running a $1.32 trillion deficit. And I've been asking for the last couple of years, where are my T-Twizzlers? Where are all the people with the Gadsden flag? Don't tread on me. Taxed enough already. Where are they? Have we lost them? Did they lock them up? Put them under glass? Did they all die? I don't know, because haven't heard from them. Nowhere to be found. And the thing that gets me is that we're spending a S-ton of money on defense spending. In 2020, our defense spending will go up to $738 billion. That is not including all of our misadventures overseas. That's a whole nother category of, hey, whatever you want, blank check. 2021, you're going to see military spending going up to $741 billion, almost three quarters of $1 trillion. And I can't help but think about, you know, what could we do in this country with half of that? Just $350 billion. What could we do? What could we invest in? What could we fix? What could we rebuild? What could we move forward? What could we expand? Well, no, because we're never going to find out. And this is where Jack Ma, the guy who's the head of Alibaba, is right. You know, we have spent so much time, energy, money, resource, national treasure, national mind power on blowing things up and wanting to blow things up. No, we haven't fixed ourselves. So the Republicans got almost all that they wanted. They wanted more defense spending. Democrats wanted some domestic spending here at home, and you will see $632 billion spent domestically here in 2020, $635 domestically in 2021. That's a little bit of bump. They're saying, I guess it's $55 billion more bump. Or 55 million more bump over the years. So, you know, again, this is one of those moments where you go, we're not broke. Clearly not broke. We're getting broke. We're spending ourselves into a hole. It's troubling. And I'm always looking at that big debt number, which we're now going to blow past $22 trillion and real quickly. I always look at that and go, you know, you got to worry about that a little bit. And I, you know, look, I wouldn't be as worried if we were actually doing things for real investments instead of, you know, funneling it into the military industrial complex. And I've said this before, I'm not a fan of the military. And on any level, I think it's a lot of wasteful spending. I think it gets us into too many foreign endeavors. And I think we're just, as Smedley Butler said, a high priced muscle for big business. I respect and honor the people who wear the uniform and sacrifice and bleed and die for these causes. But the institution I struggle with, because you find stories like this one. Evidently, the Army just let it slip. Oops. That they've been using Black Hawk helicopters to fly over Washington, D.C. These are active duty and reserve soldiers who have been, you know, I got for who knows why. But the guess is maybe they're trying to protect the White House. That's the first thing we're just trying to protect the president. And you go, well, that's what the Secret Service is for. I'm a little uncomfortable with the military conducting operations right here at home. Just a little uncomfortable. But it came out because they've asked for an additional amount of money, $1.55 million for aircraft maintenance. And that raised the attention of some of those fake news reporters who began asking questions like, well, why do you need this? This is also part of a $2.5 billion request this month to quote unquote reprogram funds from the current budget. You know, to programs that they think are high priority programs. This one being one of them. And what was written by over at Bloomberg, they said soldiers from Assault Helicopter Company and aviation maintenance units will be supporting the mission with 10 UH-60s and maintenance capabilities for 4 months. Sensitive compartmented information facilities at Davison Airfield, Army Airfield, and Fort Belvoir, Virginia, just outside of Washington. They go on to say that... The Army didn't comment on the email that they sent them. So we're just left to surmise what they're going to repurpose $2.5 billion for while flying Black Hawk helicopters over Washington, D.C. Again, little uncomfortable when you've got an authoritarian minded guy in the White House and you have a military industrial complex that really, you know, has its snout deeply in the government trough. little worried, always a little concerned when they get a little too cozy. Because, you know, in tin pot dictatorships, the military usually leads the coups and the takeovers and all of that. And it's not good. Not good at all. And speaking of not good, and I mentioned the word tick a little earlier. And again, another one of these reasons that I'm distrustful of the military-industrial complex. Evidently, and I just found this out, that... And this is because of Chris Smith, the Republican from New Jersey, the Republican congressman who's evidently one of the co-chairs. And I didn't know. I guess there's a caucus for everything in Congress today. But there's a House Lyme Disease Caucus. Did not know this, but there's a Lyme Disease Caucus. And as co-chair of the Lyme Disease Caucus, they have introduced a piece of legislation titled TICS, Identify, Control, and Knockout Act, the TICS Act. This comes up with a national strategy on how to fight Lyme disease and how to, spend, I guess, like $180 million on research to boost funding to, when you're bitten by one of these ticks, on how to survive. And, I've been saying for a while, when I was a kid, no idea what a tick was. Now, granted, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland where, it was an industrial site. So maybe they couldn't breathe. I don't know. We didn't have deer in our neighborhood. So, them jumping around deer to deer probably was never going to happen. But never, even playing in the woods, in the park or wherever, never a thought of ticks. We now find out that there was a program from 1950 until like 1975 where they were doing some work with biological weaponry. Chris Smith is saying that he believes, and what they've come to understand is that evidently they want to know if the DOJ or the DOD had weaponized ticks. And you go, what? In fact, Chris Smith has put forth an amendment asking certain questions, and the questions being, what were the parameters of this program that were supposedly to weaponize these insects? Who ordered it? Was there ever an accidental release of these ticks or at any time these disease ticks? Were there any ticks released by design? And did the program contribute to the disease's burden? They also say, could any of this information help with current research? Because, look, from what I'm hearing, really bad. We've got a bad tick problem. And this is another one of those moments where, is it conspiracy theory like LSD? The CIA put it into, and the military put it into, out there so all the soldiers would get hooked. The enemies, only it was our people who ended up getting hooked. Will it be another one of those? I don't know. But again, this is another one of those moments where I struggle with, we hand over so much money and power to the military-industrial complex without any real oversight. And it's all because it's national security, top secret, high classified. Sorry, not a big believer in high classified. This, one of those reasons why. But just a couple of things that banged around in my head today that I thought interesting and well, sad all at the same time. Any tea twizzlers out there? Love to hear from you. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Curious, we anywhere near upset about blowing past $22 trillion? I know you were crazy when it was the black guy in the White House who was spending a little money to dig us out of massive recession. This is supposed to be the best economy ever, and we're spending more than Obama was allowed to spend. I mean, let that sink in for a second. We were in free fall. The economy was in free fall. We were losing 1 million jobs a month. And the Republicans were against any stimulus package to help move us out of it. They were against any stimulus package to prime the pump, so to speak. And yet now all we're doing is priming the pump. Only we're priming the pumps of the very, very well-to-do. Because guess what? It still ain't trickling down to you and me. And that's a problem. and one of these reasons why 2020 is so important. And we come back and talk a little bit about the upcoming debates, the upcoming election, and also lots of stuff going on this week. So when we come back, our good friend David Yankovich is going to be here to share some of his thoughts on, well, you know, the messaging, the campaigns, and where things are going to go this week. Quick break. Right back with our good friend David. Stick around.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up. Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1916. That was the day a bomb rocked the Preparedness Day parade in San Francisco, killing 10 and injuring at least 40. The Chamber of Commerce and the newly formed Law and Order Committee organized the parade to shore up support for war production and eventual entry into World War I. But isolationist sentiment in San Francisco remained strong. Anti-war activists prepared pamphlets and protests for the march. Many trade unionists were opposed to entry into the war. Some considered the parade a response to the combative longshoremen strike raging on the docks for weeks. San Francisco had been a strong union town for years, known for strikes and labor disputes. 1916 was an election year, and already the city had been rocked by a number of strikes. Business interests launched an open shop campaign and began targeting labor radicals. They found their scapegoats in labor leaders Tom Mooney and Warren Billings, who were framed and convicted for the bombings. Journalist Carl Nolte points out that Mooney and his assistant had been trying to organize workers at the city's largest streetcar company, United Railroads. He notes their convictions were based on perjured testimony and doctored evidence. Incredibly, one of the prosecution's star witnesses wasn't even in town that day. But the convictions served to vilify labor militants as terrorists. Fremont Older, editor of two local newspapers, discovered the frame-up evidence. He and many others, including Upton Sinclair and Clarence Darrow, campaigned for years to free the two men. They were finally released after 22 years in 1939. The actual bombers were never found, though some have speculated that anarchists of the Galleanist movement were likely responsible.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So our quote of the day from Elizabeth Warren, and I'm beginning to like her an awful lot more. I mean, like I said, I love her policies. She's got a written plan for absolutely everything. But, you know, there's part of me that, you know, look, I haven't decided who I'm supporting yet. There's a bunch of people I like. But Warren's, coming out closer to the top. She said in an article, some people think small change, incremental change. She's talking about Joe Biden, if you need to know, is how we will move America in a better direction. I think big change is easier. She goes on to say it's easier to get more people into the fight, and it's easier to get more people to pay attention to how it will touch their lives, she says, and that's the path to winning. So this is the ask for big or ask for little. She says ask for big, and I agree. This is one of those things that, you know, you need real substantial change. You need to be talking to people about, hey, how are we going to turn this rigged economy around? How are we going to return reward to work? How are we going to make, you know, that belief that I grew up with, that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you actually get ahead. Just a great bit there. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the big debates coming up. Also Wednesday's little hearing, our good friend David Yankovich. He's a digital strategist, also former congressional candidate. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, glad to be back, Rick.
So what do you think? Big, bold change is what we need.
Oh, even if I disagreed, I'm not going to get in the middle of Elizabeth Warren's social media supporters. Jeez.
You're smart enough not to do that.
Yeah, you know, I've been doing this long enough now, I think. I finally got it. You just basically don't piss anybody off, right? No, but she's amazing. First off, talk cheap. Then she puts plans out. So she's got a plan for everything. I mean, she's doing a lot of things right, and social media wise, she is, and also that's kind of what America is all about, isn't it? Like, we dream big, we do big things. Like, that's kind of the way we all grew up. I mean, yeah, we just talked about the 50 years of since Apollo 11 and everything else. Go big. I mean, what's the point otherwise? I don't want to live in a world in a country where we're incrementally thinking about what we can do from day to day. I mean, let's go for the big picture of everything and a big plan and fight for it and duke it out. And you know, I mean, you get a lot more change done when you're going for the big stuff and not the little stuff.
And it's one of those things I've said for years. I mean, you know, we need union negotiators. You're negotiating this stuff, you know, because Republicans do this really, really well. They ask for the world, the sun, the moon. They want it all, and they'll settle for a little bit less. Democrats, they'll start negotiating at what they'll accept, and then work their way back. I mean, the minimum wage is a perfect example. You had unions out there going, "Hey, we want $15 an hour in a union." And immediately you got Democrats going, "Well, how about 10-10? You went, "No, 10-10 is what you might settle for. It's not where you start."
No one's ever accused us of being good negotiators, for sure. there's a lot of times I'm watching the news or, you know, I'm in hearings or in meetings or whatever, and it doesn't make sense a lot of the thought process that goes into some of this stuff. I'm not going to negotiate with somebody for what, like, anything. If I'm going to get a car, I'm negotiating up. You know, like, I mean, that's what you do. You don't want to go into this and be like, "Oh, I'm going to go with my, you know, with my acceptable rate right off the bat." No, you want to start off with something that's going to hurt the other person two or three times the amount of what you are. And, that's where we are. And the party's not very good at that. And Honestly, what it comes down to, though, is the same thing that you and I have always talked about, which is courage. They don't have the courage or the confidence to walk into the room and be like, "We're going to walk out of this and we're going to embarrass you on every piece of news, every piece of media, every radio show. We're going to come to your events. We're going to send trackers after you." Like, if you don't do what we want to do, you're going to have a really bad month. No. Democrats don't do that. We're like, "We're going to go high. They're going to go low."
No, and this is where I've been saying there are some people that are talking about building a movement. One of the things I like about Bernie Sanders is the talk of building a movement, a political revolution. And, you know, he was asked about the minimum wage since I brought it up a moment ago. And he said, "You know what? If Mitch McConnell doesn't bring it up, we go to Kentucky and we hold rallies every one of his Senate offices. We start rallying the hell out of Kentucky until it's impossible for him to not consider increasing the minimum wage."
That's also what the McConnells of the party of, you know, and everybody else, they hope for, right? They know that, like, H.R. 1, the most sweeping anti-corruption legislation since Watergate, was passed by the House this year. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, the stuff that's in here, anti-gerrymandering, anti-corruption, I mean, it makes our dark money go away. I mean, everything in this bill is perfect. What does Mitch McConnell do? Just ignores it, because he knows the Democrats aren't strong or tough enough to actually make a big enough stink about it. So he can just put that in a drawer and laugh at us. And he literally did. He laughed at it.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing. I mean, since 1978, Rick, like, 1978 was, I mean, the last time that, like, really there's been, like, real buying power with income. I mean, it's insane. Like, since that point, income's only gone up 5.7% for the average worker. Like, that's it.
Oh, I know. I lived most of that. Yeah. I was there.
But the CEO wealth is up over 900%. And that's the argument that the Democrats can't win, which drives me insane. Because it's not the fact that, you know, your boss is even a jerk and everything else, although he probably is. It's the owners of your companies. It's the CEO wealth. It's, you know, the minimum wage guy, he's got a minimum wage supervisor. He's got to know our minimum wage. And then you get the middle wages. You know, we can win this argument. We can win all of these arguments if we're just a little more courageous about it. And that's the thing that kills me about the Democrats right now, is the messaging. We talk about that all the time, too. We got to have a lot more courage.
Yeah.
And we have to be willing to go toe-to-toe with the Republicans and not take their crap and really embarrass them. And we just, you know, we always have that mindset. We're going to go high and they're going to go low, but they're going low, they're getting stuff done. We're going high, you know, and we keep having the same issues.
Yeah, as I say, when they go low, you step on the back of their head and smash their face in the ground. Not in a violent way.
No, and metaphorically.
Yes. You know, look, you know, when I played football, it was one of those things. First thing the coach taught you is when they come for your knees, you push their head right into the dirt. That's a survival thing that evidently, had I said to my football coach, "No, when they go low, I'm going to go high," he'd have sat me on the bench.
Well, enjoy that flying through the air motion you're about to have in 2 seconds.
or that. You put me out there just to enjoy that. And then mock me during films on Monday. Yeah, you're probably right there. But, you know, this is one of those things where you're right. We do need bold Democrats, which is why I think the squad's taken so many arrows. While, you know, there may be some things that I'm not so thrilled about that they've said in the past. They are bold. They are unapologetic, and they're pushing for change.
Oh, and it's the perfect moment for the Republicans and the Fox News and everything else. They have this group of women, and they're mostly women with names that don't sound like they're American. So they can fundraise off it. These people are not, you know, they're here. They don't care about America. Like, this is perfect for the Republican Party because Nancy Pelosi is not the biggest boogeyman for them anymore.
No.
You know, it's not Chuck Schumer. It's, you know, they have to create something new. And Trump always has to have a new enemy anyway. Just to continuously move on and dominate the news cycles and everything else. This is all political strategy because in places in the Midwest and in places where, you know, it's a little bit more rural and a lot more white, these five women scare the living crap out of these white men. They do. And it brings in money and it makes people mad. And you're not getting the whole story. It's all political theater. It's all strategy. And the Republicans are so much better at the political theater of this and rallying up their base and doing everything else.
Well, I mean, the reality, David, and we've talked about this, you and I, privately over the years. I mean, without Fox News, without talk radio, you don't have these Trump rallies. You don't have send her back. You don't have lock her up. You don't have any of the what you see when he does one of these rallies is kind of like a church revival where everybody in the pews, they've been studying the prayer book, man. And that's what talk radio and Fox News has done. They've created all of these, the flock, if you will, that Trump just goes out there and plays like a maestro.
And I will say this for anybody out there who's listening right now, that when Rick and I talk privately, it's a lot more profane. but it's true. And I mean, the thing you know, comes back to me a lot of the time on this stuff is that the Democrats don't understand what Trump and the Republicans do, which is that this is entertainment. And I know that it shouldn't be entertainment. I know that, you know, people's lives are in a balance. I know that healthcare is in a balance and all of this, but there's something to be said about the fact that, you know, they have these giant rallies and there's lights and it's, you know, big theatrical cinematic video trailers of campaign stuff or on the GOP side. And the Democrats, they're trying to actually govern. And they're trying to govern in the reality TV age of social media, movie star stuff and, you know, everything else. And they're actually trying to, for the most part, get things done from a governmental level. And the Republicans just don't care about any of that.
Nope.
That's why they can look right into a camera, lie, point at the other side, say you're an idiot, and just get away with it. Because honestly, like, the country just doesn't care. And here's a really good example. This happened today. There's a tracker that, you know, the Republicans sent to Doug Jones. And, the trackers ask him all kinds of stupid questions about, you know, why are you not supporting the people of Alabama and on and on and on. And Doug actually eating an ice cream sandwich as he's walking. And basically, as he just gets friendly to the guy and kind of jokes around with him. Then he gets in and he goes, you ask a lot of stupid questions, to close the door. And every Republican from, you know, all the news sites and everything else came out and said that Jones wasn't answering questions and that he's scared and he's running off. And if anybody actually watches the video, they're going to see a senator eating an ice cream sandwich laughing his butt off at this. And it's just, that's the narrative right now. That's, you can look into a camera, video doesn't even matter anymore. I mean, especially with deep fakes and everything else now. It's all about the entertainment value. It's all about just saying things that are inflammatory into a camera or in a tweet and getting people riled up.
No, you're right. Because here's the thing. I mean, this sender back thing has caught my attention simply because, you know, I lived through the Obama years. I have this thing called a memory. It hasn't gone completely yet. I still remember all of the Republicans, you know, just losing their mind, especially the T-twits who seem to be really silent with the trillion-dollar debts that we've been running up the last couple of years. But I remember them, you know, just losing their minds about, you know, how bad things were and how, you know, when the country's being ruined and all of this, and Trump himself, he's called the country a laughingstock. He's called the country a third nation world, a country, a foolish country, a dying country, a dumb country. He said all of this, not exceptional, and all of these things. And yet he stayed. Why during the Obama years, didn't they all pack up the van, gather the sheep and get the flock out?
is another one too. I think about is the evangelicals during the Clinton administration, and all the morality, and he's not moral. And you have a president who's literally he's incredibly accused of sexual assault by 20 women now. A couple weeks ago, is like one of the most well known writers, and still nothing. I mean, that's the thing. That's the reason why I say all this. None of this matters. The only thing that matters in politics right now is getting the word out. And being as loud as you possibly can. And really, it's just, I mean, you got to go low. I mean, and here's something for everybody out there who's listening that I have been watching very closely. Donald Trump is the greatest person that we've ever seen on social media. You can argue with me. You can fill my mentions up all you want to.
I don't.
You lose. And I know you don't, but I get this. But the problem with this is Donald Trump has so much more than, like, if you take Elizabeth Warren, Buttigieg, if you take Joe Biden, if you take our top five, Harris, and we put them all in there, Trump is still getting 60% more retweets, impressions, favorites, activity around his account. Like, and take our five best Democrats in the party, the five loudest, most smart Democrats who get the most attention. They don't even get half the attention that Donald Trump gets on social media. That's a big problem. And that's something we got to fix going into 2020. It's unbelievable how upside down we are on social media and digital versus this president. And he's already put, what, $25, $30 million in ads on Facebook. So all this misinformation, all this political theater, all this crap that they're throwing at us, we're getting killed.
Yeah.
We're getting killed on social and digital. And we have to really start organizing fast and hard on this stuff. And, and again, I keep going back to this and I tell people, like, I don't want it to be entertainment because it should not be entertainment. This is governing. But on the other side, like, the people only have an attention span of like 20 or 30 seconds tops. Sometimes not even that much. Sometimes 5 seconds tops.
Yeah.
So how are we going to win that argument if we can't fight on the same parameters that they are?
No, I mean, I look at all these memes I see, you know, that come by, you know, and you're right. It's not 20 seconds anymore. It's like seven. The last bit that I saw on this, it's like 7 seconds. Our attention span is that of about the lifespan of a gnat. But they do so much better at throwing out these memes and this stuff that gets shared and believed. For instance, you know, I was talking to a couple of guys who, you know, I don't think they're stupid, but, you know, they literally came out and said to me that, well, AOC said that, you know, we don't need farms because there's plenty of food in the supermarket. And I'm going, she never said that. Well, I saw it on Facebook, and they saw one of these memes of a picture of hers with a quote on it, and they believed it because, hey, it's on the internet. You got to believe what's on the internet.
But see, that goes deeper. It's not just that it's on the internet and someone believed it. They're actively training and recruiting people to create this content day after day after day right now.
Right.
And in the United States, it doesn't happen. I'm sure in other countries, too, that interfere with our elections, like Russia and China and everything else. But in the United States, like Palm Beach was a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, they literally held a class called Owning the Libs. And it was all about creating memes to piss libs off. And that's it. I mean, that was their entire class. It was sanctioned by the Republican National Committee, and it's an official thing, basically, of them creating content to mess up liberals and make them mad. And that's the bigger problem. So, like, we're talking about this, like, your friend, and, you know, they see the AOC thing, and this happens to me sometimes as well. But the bigger problem is that the Republican Party is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in this a year, and the Democratic Party, when you talk to them about it, they look at you and they go, what's the mean?
Yep.
And I swear to God that happened.
No. I've been beating my head against the wall for 14 years doing this program, trying to scrape up every bit of funding possible. And I've been telling them, you know, even 14 years ago, I was saying, look, the GOP and the conservative right, they've got a 20-year head start on you already. Now it's a 30-plus year head start in building infrastructure to be in people's ears. And this is, you know, one of the things I talked about at Netroots Nation. You know, the reality is we don't have the same megaphone. We're not speaking on the same platforms. And you've got to invest in that stuff. If you're not talking to people where they are, they're not seeking out. They're not going to Elizabeth Warren's website to read her plans like I do, because they're too long and they're hard to find. But if a meme comes across their Facebook page or they see it on Twitter, you know, you've now got them.
Yep. And 80% of people now get their news from social media,
yep,
and not from traditional media. And everybody's cutting the cord. So, I mean, this is only going to become a bigger problem. We're only going to get, you know, more and more outpaced on this. And, you know, the scary thing is we're going into 2020, and there's so many Democrats that I talk to that think that we just have this whole thing in the bag. There is no possible way that Donald Trump gets elected again. There's no possible way that the Senate stays in power.
Really? First you off, find these people?
Yeah. I know. This is the conversations I have with people, and it's like very... I would be willing to bet you that we will not win the Senate this cycle unless we organize crazily, unless we really put... I mean, the map is not in our favor still.
No.
We have a lot of work to do. We might be able to save some of the senators out there who we really care about, who fight for us, but it's an uphill battle. And there is no guarantee whatsoever in this moment right now that Donald Trump will not lose or become, you know... It's just we don't have the numbers. It's not there right now.
No, and look,
And I'm trying to tell people this, like, organize, get 20 of your friends. And I know I sound like a broken record when I say this crap. And I realize, to me, I get tired of saying it. I get tired of hearing myself say it. But if everybody thinks that we're going to win and you're not, like, pulling in every single person you ever met in your life to go vote, we're probably not going to. Like, this is so epic and so big and so important and critical. Like, everybody needs to be involved in this on social media, too. They need to be developing social media armies and DM rooms and Facebook groups for every candidate that they support. Like, there needs to be a top-down, bottom-up, like, operation amongst the grassroots, the party, everybody. And the Republicans are planning on winning this war on digital. I mean, they've already stated it, basically, and they're putting millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars online every month. And it's just all we can do at this point now is organize our butts off and get it done. And it just drives me nuts because I do have these conversations and people are like, no, I think we're going to win. There's no way Trump wins in 2020. He only had 24% of the vote last time, but people don't understand that at this moment now, he's still gaining support. He's still bringing people in and his approval rating has not moved. He's still sitting 44-45%, and he has been. All he needs to do is pick up a couple independents and he wins again. All he needs to do is win Michigan and Ohio and Florida. Or any of these. And, you know, it's going to happen all over again.
Yeah, and we've done nothing really to undo the voter suppression and the things that you could argue happened in 2016. But I've already predicted that unless the economy goes down, unless we enter another recession, I don't see how the Democrats right now, I don't see how they beat him because right now they're eating each other. And he, like you said, he's got more attention than all of them put together.
Yeah, I mean, he's got more attention of it, and it's just, I mean, that's where we are. And as we move forward closer to 2020, and as we get closer to the election, there's going to be more and more dirty tricks and nasty stuff that happens, and the Democrats just aren't prepared for it. And I'm not trying to be a naysayer. I believe that they could change everything they wanted to if they wanted to. I just don't know if they want to or, you know, where their mindset on this is, but these numbers aren't lying to them. I mean, take our top five most popular Democrats, and we don't even break 50% against Donald Trump in terms of getting the attention. And we're looking at Senate races, some Senate races where, you know, we have United States senators with 6,000 followers going up against, and, you know, people who are running against them with 200,000. And, like, these moments and these things that we can start doing to build this out now, I mean, we have to move. And it's only going to get harder.
No, I'm with you. So let me ask you last line of questioning. The debates are coming up. Have we picked a side yet? Are we leaning anyway? And what do you expect to come out of these debates?
Well, I have not picked a side. What I will say, I have not publicly picked a side. What I will say in this, though, I'm watching really closely to see who I think can actually stand on the debate stage against Donald Trump and not get embarrassed. I mean, you can be nice all you want to. You can have all the plans you want to. You can have a revolution all you want to. Like, you can be the status quo candidate all you want to, but it's a whole different animal standing on a stage with a guy who does not care about any of that and will literally bring out every single piece of dirt that's ever happened in your life and try to destroy you right there.
Yeah, it goes back to the Mike Tyson quote, "Everyone's got a plan until I punch him in the nose."
Exactly. Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the nose or mouth, but yeah. And that's the thing for me that I'm looking at. I want to see the candidate who's going to go up there and not be afraid to look Donald Trump right in the face and just be like, you're an idiot.
Yeah, everyone seems to think that after the last debate, the performance, it's Kamala Harris.
I mean, she's very tough. But it's a whole other thing, too, to see her in a different situation against a sitting president. You know, and my thing, too, is we have, 15 more debates to go. What happens if we all rally behind Kamala right now and she tanks 6 months from now? Or Elizabeth, or Bernie, or Biden, or anybody. I want to see the best Democratic candidate come out of this, who is the strongest, the toughest, and the most well-funded. And that's it. And I'm not going to publicly take a position or, you know, rally behind anybody or anything right now, unless something happens for me where I'm like, okay, like, there's no, you know...
That's
it. Second guessing this.
That's where I'm at. You know, I want to see who has the best ground game, because you're really going to need to build that out.
That's an interesting take. I want to see who has the best digital game. I want to see who has the best social media brand building game, the army building game.
I put that in the same boat.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to see who connects the best, who has the best volunteers, the growing number of people willing to do social media. I want to see all that stuff. It's one thing to stand on the debate stage and have a good deliver the good punchline that you practiced. It's another to have a bunch of the army behind you, who's going to march forward. So we'll see. What are you expecting for the debates? I was expecting the race question, the last one. What are you expecting in this upcoming one?
Well, still, Joe Biden is leading most of the polls, so everybody is going to be after him on that debate stage. So the interesting thing for me is going to be like the last breath of candidates, the ones who need to have, like, last debate going into that when Kamala Harris was in trouble. If you would have asked me the day before what I thought her chances of being the nominee were versus after, I mean, I would have said 0-50, you know. She didn't raise any money last quarter, really, and she was having a lot of trouble bringing in support after that debate moment, and that was a great moment that she had planned out, and she organized it, and she had merchandise and everything else. You know, she went after Biden, and that basically saved her in the race for another month or two. That's what's going to happen in this debate, and as it gets more and more critical for other candidates to raise money and to stay in the race and try to stay alive in this, they're going to start going after, you know, Buttigieg, Harris, Warren, Biden, and Bernie. And that's just the way it's going to go, because, I mean, all the candidates from the bottom have to take out somebody from the top to get there. And so it's going to get nasty. This debate is going to be a lot harder. Of course, the race questions are going to come up. The detention centers are going to come up. But most interesting to me is going to be Democrats trying to knife other Democrats, and how effective is that going to be for the long run for us?
Yeah, let the Hunger Games begin.
Yeah, let the Hunger Games begin.
There you go. David, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you. Please come back again soon.
Always. Thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend David Yankovich, one of my favorite folks. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
This day in labor history, the year was 1877. A group of labor leaders and members of the Working Men's Party met in St. Louis. They were there because of the labor strike that had swept the nation. The United States was in the grip of a terrible depression. Railroad workers in Martinsburg, West Virginia, had walked off the job after their wages were slashed. The popular uprising of workers spread to cities like Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and Chicago. Railroad tracks were ripped out of the ground. Workers rallied and protested, and workers from other industries joined the March of Labor. In St. Louis, the response of workers was even more radical. Many of the workers in the city were German immigrants. Some remembered the working class uprisings of 1848 in Germany. At the St. Louis meeting, they declared the start of the St. Louis Commune, a takeover of the city by working people. They called for the eight-hour day and the end of child labor. On both sides of the Mississippi River, both in St. Louis and East St. Louis, workers began a general strike. Railroad traffic was stopped. It was the first general strike in U.S. history. The workers had taken over St. Louis. 3,000 federal troops were amassed, along with thousands of gun thugs paid for by the railroad tycoons. The workers' rebellion was crushed. The strike committee was arrested, and at least 18 people were killed. Across the nation, 100 people lost their lives in the great upheaval of 1877. City leaders scrambled to build armories so they could quickly arm troops in case the workers rose up again.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So real quick, in the Facebook chat room, Gene points out about the debt ceiling issue. And I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that any debt ceiling deal would undo the screwquester, would stop any of the mandatory cuts that Republicans so wanted during the Obama years. And that's what I was talking about when there were the mandatory spending cuts that are now going to be averted. I think the number was $55 billion of domestic spending and $71 billion in defense spending. That's not going to happen because of this deal. She also points out that, and rightly so, that this is going to be a way to fund the unfunded mandate of the tax cuts that we handed out to the very wealthy. So, hey, good for us. And again, for me, this is one of those moments where, you know, Democrats, you got to drive a harder bargain. You got to do a much better job of negotiating. And I've always said, you know, Republicans negotiate like this. We want to chop off both of your legs. We got to have both legs. Sorry, you know, just got to chop them both off. And Democrats, well, no, can you just take one? And, well, they take one. Okay, we'll take one. We're compromising. And they come back 6 months later. Well, we really need the other leg now. And Democrats are like, no, can you just maybe up to the knee? Until eventually down the road, they get both legs. It just takes a little bit of time. And when Democrats, you know, say they want both legs, they'll start, well, we'll settle for the toenail. We'll start there. They just don't have the same negotiating skills. Just is what it is. And here again, look at the Affordable Care Act. Perfect example. Republicans want to destroy it. They tried to go through the conventional ways, tried to get Congress to vote it down. Fortunately, John McCain gave the thumbs down about 2 years ago. And what did Trump do almost immediately? They came out with these, making mini plans great again. This junk health care, which is basically just a catastrophic plan that basically covers nothing. It was one of those mini plans that you used to get the fast food joints where you got a nice shiny card, but it didn't do anything. Unless maybe if you had a heart attack, it would cover something, but it had to be really bad. Well, evidently, U.S. District Judge Richard Leone, he has ruled that these crappy mini plans, these, I forget what they call them. It's one of these. It's one of these really kind of Orwellian names, but they're mini plans. They cover nothing. They're lower cost, and the idea is, from the conservative argument, is, well, the healthier people who just want catastrophic, you know, they just need what's good for them. They get to choose what's best for them at that moment. What they're really doing, and understand the point here, is really very smart on their part. If your goal is to destroy it, if your goal really is to destroy the Affordable Care Act, what do you do? Well, you create the death spiral that you say is happening. And you do that by taking the healthy people out of it. See, this is one of the things that the Affordable Care Act did. It said, look, if you don't buy the insurance, if you don't cover yourself, if you don't have personal responsibility, we're gonna fine you through the IRS. We're going to charge you a tax, and it'll be significant, and you'll pay something into the system to help offset the cost of the people who are less healthy, of the people with pre-existing conditions, so that everyone's in the same kind of pool, that the healthy people and the sick people are together, and you somehow middle that out. Well, what Trump is doing and the administration is saying, we're going to take those well people, you know, the healthy young people, and we're going to let them buy these crappy plans again, because they're probably not going to need them for 10 or 15 years. So they can get away with not, you know, look, if they break an arm, it's a couple thousand dollars. They can take that out of pocket. But they're going to save money on their premiums. But more importantly, we're going to pull them out of the pool so that the rates skyrocket on the people left in the pool. And this is what the death spiral was, right? This is what they argue was going to happen. All of the well people were going to bail. The government system was going to be just left with all the sickly, the people were, just had all these horrible pre-existing conditions that nobody wanted to cover. And the prices would just be astronomical. And states would go broke because of it. This is their argument. And they're working on making sure that comes to fruition. So when this judge rules that these little micro plans are A-OK, because in his opinion, they're not going to harm the existing plan. In fact, he writes, there's no evidence the rule is having or will have the type of impact, substantial exodus from the individual market exchanges that would threaten the ACA's survival and structural core. I disagree with that, because these short-term policies that they want, what it's doing is it's taking healthy people out of it. Because, hey, we want these cheap plans. So what happens as soon as this ruling comes out? These two companies, the Health Insurance Innovations Incorporated and eHealth Incorporated, their stock prices skyrocketed. Because they know they're going to be able to sell these crummy plans. And I go back to something I talked about probably well over a year ago. Right when these things first came out, a truck driver guy I knew was selling insurance part-time, health insurance. He goes to me, and I love this story. It's one of my favorites. He says, do you need health insurance? And I go, yeah, actually I do. What do you got? He goes, I don't know, but it's cheap. And I'm going, whoa. Explain that to me. He goes, the premiums are really low. They're like $55 a month. I'm going, well, what does it cover? He goes, well, I don't really know. I go, so you're selling me insurance, right? He goes, yeah. I go, but what does it cover? Well, I don't really know. I'm going, so then you're not selling me anything. You're just asking me for $55 a month. Only to find out they cover nothing. It's a massive high deductible plan. It's your basic old school catastrophic plan. Doesn't pay for yearly checkups, doesn't pay for, any preventative anything. It's purely in the event you get cancer, you're going to go broke in about a year instead of 6 months. That's basically what it is. So the question then becomes, how quickly is this going to harm the ACA, and what happens when it implodes? Because that's what they're setting up. And how many people struggle and suffer because of it? And this is why I think this is a real major campaign issue this year. Because, look, they clearly have it in their mindset that they have to destroy the Affordable Care Act. Now, is it perfect? No. I've said for years, I think there's a lot to be desired here. They're way too high deductibles. The costs are way too high. I've said numerous times, I think you should just let the unions do health insurance. They seem to do it so much better and so much more cost effective. Because guess what? They don't have CEOs that they're paying hundreds of millions of dollars to. They don't have massive ad budgets that they're running on, TV, radio, everywhere. It makes no sense to me why any of these insurance companies, given the fact that there are only one or two insurers in most areas across the country anyway, why they need to advertise, other than there's kickback schemes somewhere to be had. So to me, this is one of the number one campaign issues I think Democrats run on. This is one of the weaknesses that the Republicans have, because their only plan is pay or die. Now, you walk across the stage on, the 20 candidates, they've all got different plans. I think Buttigieg's idea of Medicare for people who want it is a great idea. That's what I was That was what I was campaigning for in 2010. Simply a public option. Open up Medicare. Tell me how much it costs to fix a price to it. Let me buy into it at any age. Or look, start as some people want at 50 years old. Get the older people into it earlier. Lower that age from 65 down to 50. Throw a premium on top of it and move forward. Would help companies by not having to insure the older and sicker people. And it would make sure that people have the ability to retire. We've got a retirement crisis coming up. I talk to people every day who'd say, you know, if it weren't for my wife being sick or me being sick or, you know, my kid being sick or something, I'd be gone. I'd be out of here by now. And you know what that would have meant in 2010? Had we a public option that would allowed people 55 and older to retire? You know what that would have meant for the younger generation? You know, the generation we've saddled with massive debt? That would have meant there would have been jobs open for them. And a lot of them. Because I'll tell you right now, if you lowered the Medicare age to 55, even if you put a small premium on top of it, along with the supplemental plan that you have to buy to go with Medicare, even if you did that, you would see a mass exodus from the job market of people 55 and older. You would see people heading for the exits quickly. And there's part of me that goes, that's why corporate America doesn't want it. Because to me, the idea that corporate America would want to continue to be a benefits administrator instead of just a company that makes whatever widget or whatnot they do and you know pursues their profit, why they would want to hold on to healthcare is beyond me. Other than the fact that they've done a masterful job of shifting the cost responsibility onto the people who work. You know, now I'm 52. In my lifetime, when I started working, the thought that you would have to pay for healthcare was a completely foreign concept. If you would have told me when I started working that you had to co-pay for healthcare, I'd have said you're crazy. Because it was a benefit that was part of your wage package. It was commonplace. And then slowly they've done a masterful job of saying, well, you know, you need to have skin in the game. I love that nonsensical, idiotic argument. Little skin in the game. No, the skin in the game is that I work for you. That's the skin in the game. The skin in the game is I took a little bit lower pay raise. I have less in my paycheck to ensure that I have health care, that my children have health care. And then they started this crap. Well, we'll just cover the worker, and then you have to pay extra for your spouse and then extra for your children. So what pops up? Now we got CHIP programs that cover kids whose companies refuse to cover the family anymore. It's masterful how corporate America has screwed over the working class in this country. And we've just kind of gone, okay, just happy to have a job. So when I tell people as a member of a labor union, as a card-carrying Teamster, my health insurance is paid for. I don't pay anything out of my pocket. It's part of my compensation. It's part of what the labor cost number that's negotiated. But I don't have to kick back anything at the end of the week. It's already taken out. It's paid for. And I can't tell you how many people say, well, yeah, that's unheard of. You should have to pay for your healthcare. I do. I pay for every penny of it through lower wages. Problem is most workers in this country haven't figured that out. And what they've gotten is the lower wages and, that's right, the contribution to their health care. So when David a moment ago said, you know, since 1978, the working class of this country has only seen about a 5% raise over that entire period where the boss, the CEO, has seen over a 900% increase. When you look at that number, you know, Matt Bruning did a study not too long ago that said the top 1% took $21 trillion while the bottom half of the economy lost almost $1 trillion in wealth. You wonder how that happened? This is how it happened. They destroyed health care and they eviscerated retirement security. Because again, when I started working, a defined benefit pension was not unusual. Today, finding a defined benefit pension fund in this country to start a job is like finding the Holy Grail. It would be like finding a needle in the haystack in the ocean. Ain't happening. So I just, you know, when I see these crappy plans that cover nothing, it angers me because, look, I know these people are getting screwed. They're going to get the short end of the stick because, hey, they're going to think they have insurance. And then if something bad happens, if they're unlucky in some way, they get sick, guess what happens? Surprise, it doesn't cover anything. Surprise, you're broke. Surprise, you're bankrupt. Surprise, you're going to be harassed for the rest of eternity by debt collectors and all of that. And it's going to ruin your credit rating. It's going to ruin your ability to get jobs. Over what? Because you got sick. How insane is that? Just wrong. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.